attention is going to mainstream Latin pop. The vacuum created by the majors has been filled by Texas-based independent record labels and mom-and-pop record stores, both of which can respond more quickly to the changing tastes of the Tejano audience. That explains the success of new labels such as Luxor, Tejas, and Chipinacé, and the resurgence of established ones, like Freddie and Joey International. Similarly, several old guard acts are enjoying renewed attention. Notably, vocalists Ram Herrera, Jay Perez, and Sherry Larez, who has breathed fire into a traditional ballad called Volver, Volver. Most eyes and ears are on Alida Reyna, the leader of Alida y Avante. The 23-year-old Valley girl from Mercedes shares Selena's natural beauty and exhibits flashes of her vocal power. But even after carrying home four trophies from this year's Tejano Music Awards, she's still cultivating a style that will separate her from the pack. There will never be another Selena, but Alida just may have the right stuff to match her firepower and become a star recognized by the rest of the Latin music world. Whether the industry can accommodate her aspirations is the musical question that has yet to be answered.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 81 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
If it's in Texas, it's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm KC Job, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site in a sound broadcasting. And our first article will be from our new May issue, and it's our cover story and feature story. We got started last week, and we'll continue that this week. This whole section is called Meet the Neighbors. It's a collective case of cabin fever. Over a year into the coronavirus pandemic, more and more of us vaccinated, we Texans are ready to get out of our homes, and yes, even out of our beloved state. Open Highway beckons with the promise of socially distant freedom and outdoor recreation. For this guide, our riders have explored fun, safe spots in five neighboring states. We're saving our big neighbor to the south for another issue. We hope these stories inspire you to choose your own fresh air adventure and hit the road. Before heading out, make sure to grab your mask, check your destination for updated COVID-19 travel guidelines. And we turn to Oklahoma, looking for bison in the Wichita Mountains. And there's a pit stop located in Okarche, about 45 minutes northwest of Oklahoma City. Eichen's Bar, circa 1896, is not only older than Oklahoma, it also serves some of the state's best fried chicken, thanks to a secret spice blend. And this whole thing is put together by Daniel Vaughn, and that was his little favorite sidebar. And there's more. Here we go. Looking for bison in the Wichita Mountains, herd immunity means something different at the Wildlife Refuge. Why did the longhorn cross the road? To get back to Texas. That's the hilarious joke I told my kids as one of the impressive ungulates ambled down the asphalt past our SUV. We'd stopped suddenly after the creature appeared from the dense fog just a few hundred feet in front of us. It was a chilly March day in the Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge, 20 miles northwest of Lawton in southwestern Oklahoma. After nearly a full day of trudging through fog that just wouldn't burn off, we'd become convinced that there were neither mountains nor the advertised free-roaming herds of bison. Refuge boasts about 650 of North America's largest mammal, but we'd at least witnessed a real-life Texas longhorn in Oklahoma. The trip was supposed to be a chance for me to get a break from my family and for them to get some time away from me. Since the pandemic started, my wife and I had worked from home while our two kids attended virtual school from their bedrooms. We love one another, but that is a lot of time together under one roof. We're lucky to live in a decent-sized house, so it's not like being trapped in an elevator together. But after a year, that's what it felt like. I wanted out. If only a brief respite. I wanted a weekend in the Wichita Mountains, where I would hike in the wilderness, gawk at roadside wildlife, and not make lunch and dinner for my children. It's my fault that things have changed. The week before the trip, my kids, 11-year-old Madeline and 9-year-old James, tagged along on an hour-long trek for barbecue. In normal times, they are frequent road trip partners for my job as Texas Monthly's barbecue editor. The short journey was unexpectedly nostalgic. The taste of liberation was too great for the children, so they begged for another outing and began hinting at the Oklahoma trip they'd heard me talking about. So in the end, solitude was achieved, just not for me. The three of us took off on a Saturday morning, leaving my wife with the house all to herself for the entire weekend. The early morning fog was thick as we headed northwest from Dallas. After 2 hours in the car, we stopped at Wichita Falls, which elicited some excitement until the kids learned we were still in Texas and had another hour of driving ahead of us. I exited the highway for a final bite of Texas barbecue at Post Oak in Burke Burnett before we crossed the border. When we went over the Red River just after noon, the fog hadn't budged. It was still there as we drove through Lawton, home of the Museum of the Great Plains, past Fort Sill, and entered the tiny town of Medicine Park on the eastern end of the Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge. Park charges no entry fees, so we drove right in, passing an empty visitor center, which was closed during my visit. Knowing the refuge doesn't have a store, we stocked up on plenty of snacks and water. Our first stop inside the refuge was the Holy City of the Wichitas. It isn't a tribute to Native American religious ceremonies, but rather a loose representation of Israel at the time of Jesus. On this site, 1926, Reverend Anthony Mark Wallach organized an Easter passion play called The Prince of Peace, which is now one of the longest-running annual passion plays in the country. Stone structures, many built by laborers employed by the Works Progress Administration in the 30s, were erected to represent Herod's court, as well as an inn with a nearby stable and a tomb with the stone rolled away. Since we weren't there at Easter, we relied on the fog for drama. With the three crosses of Calvary barely visible, I imagined the darkness that fell after the crucifixion is described in the Gospels. The mood lightened considerably when we noticed another cross away from the Calvary site that seemed intended just for photo ops. Seriously, there is a large step at the base and everything, which I guess may have been a trap set to allow the faithful to more easily identify heathens. James couldn't resist. Forgive me, Father, but it's a great photo. Before we went looking for bison, we decided to check out one more unusual and slightly unsettling feature, the parallel forest. In 1912, the government planted 20,000 eastern red cedar trees exactly 6 feet apart in every direction over 16 acres at the foot of Mount Scott in the Wichita Mountains. They were originally supposed to provide wood for future parks projects, but after the land became protected, they could no longer be cut down. The rigid rows are still quite apparent despite the undergrowth. While a few obvious paths have been cleared, there are countless side trails across the forest floor. Once you've gone deep enough into the forest to lose sight of the small parking area, it's easy to get disoriented. The forest is even said to be haunted. The tall, thin cedars look identical in every direction. It wasn't crowded, and although we were together, there was a palpable sense of solitude in this silent forest. If not for the bison we were eager to see, we might have stayed for hours. A couple of years ago, took the kids on a similar trip with similar intentions. Caprock Canyon State Park and Trailway, north of the small town of Kitty Kay in the Texas Panhandle, isn't known for its bison herd. We wondered whether we'd really see bison, but in the first 5 minutes of our visit, we found three of them just beside the road. This day wouldn't be so fruitful. We drove slowly for miles, pointing out every large object that revealed itself in the fog. Rock or bison became the game of the day, and Rock was pitching a shutout, though the prairie dogs did come out for play a bit as a consolation prize. The refuge features more than 15 miles of trails, so we decided to get out of the car and give one a try. A delightful walk along the non-strenuous mile-and-a-half Longhorn Trail, it's a short loop within the 6 mile bison trail, seemed like a reasonable way to see some wildlife. We spotted a white-tailed deer in the distance, admired some cacti, and tried not to slip and fall into French Lake, which is hugged by the second half of the trail. We could barely see the other side of the lake through the fog, but we noticed some larger figures among the trees on the hillside. There were a few head of grazing longhorn cattle, not bison, but not rocks either. The park closes at sunset, which was soon approaching, so we went back to the car to head to our hotel in nearby Lawton. At the time of our visit, limited camping was allowed, but only in RVs and travel trailers. The fog still hadn't lifted, and at this point had become almost demoralizing. I later emailed Lynn Cartmell, the refuge's visitor services manager, to ask whether this weather was a rarity. She told me it was a fairly regular occurrence. It was only as we were driving out of the park that we saw that aforementioned lone longhorn emerging from the mist. As it strolled past our vehicle, it lifted our spirits and made us hopeful for more close animal encounters the following day. Still smiling, we crossed a bridge, and that's when we spotted them, two bison grazing near the road. We stopped the car at a turnoff. Madeline had already taken her shoes off, so I carried her piggyback across the road, closer to a bison than I'd ever been without a fence separating us. James stayed behind, prepared to carry on the family legacy without us should either the bison get crosswise. They lifted their heads to acknowledge us before turning to trudge away, probably looking for greener pastures without people in them. Then they took off running. It was magnificent. All was silent except for my daughter's breath in my ear and the intense rumbling of bison hooves on the open prairie. Whatever happened the next day would just be gravy on top of this. Sunday was clear and windy. We drove into the park early. The refuge opens at sunrise, using the same route as the previous day, and it was like we were visiting a whole other place. A thick blanket of amber grass waved in the wind. In every direction we could see mountains, none of which we'd been able to make out the day before. They're ancient rocky promontories. Many are topped by granite that's half a billion years old and not all that tall. The highest elevation in the refuge that's accessible to the public is the top of Mount Scott at 2,464 feet. Mount Pinchot is an area closed to the public is 12 feet taller. The Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge isn't a state or national park. It is nearly 60,000 acres of grassland, forest, and mountains managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The area became a forest reserve in 1901 under President William McKinley, and in 1905 was declared a big game preserve by President Theodore Roosevelt, who became taken with the area after participating in a wolf hunt along with Comanche Chief Quanah Parker. 2 years later, Oklahoma became a state. Parker was born in the Wichita Mountains in the 1840s. He witnessed the decimation of bison herds, the primary sustenance of the Comanche, at the hands of white settlers and commercial hunters. In North Texas and the Panhandle, he led battles against the U.S. Army during the Red River War before surrendering to life on the Comanche Reservation at Fort Sill in 1875. Parker lived within view of the Wichita Range until his death in 1911 at his home, Star House, which still stands in Cache, just south of the refuge's border. Day two of our adventure began with the walk along the shore of Quanah Parker Lake, which is stocked with largemouth bass, catfish, and crappie for park goers who want to fish. The fierce wind raised white-capped waves on the water's surface. A waterfall off the dam on the south side surged, almost lost a hat in the wind, and while trying to catch it, nearly stumbled into a grazing longhorn. Back in the shelter of the car, we drove around the 89-acre lake, and the cruel irony set in that while we were driving to this place primarily to see bison, the two we'd encountered the day before weren't progeny of the herds from the era the Comanche ruled the plains. 15 were brought here from the New York Zoological Park, now the Bronx Zoo, in 1907, transported to Oklahoma after they had been brought to near extinction in their native habitat as part of an effort by our government to exterminate Native Americans like Parker. At least they named a lake after him. The wind kept us in the car for much of the morning, but we still saw a lot of wildlife. We stopped to let wild turkeys cross the road in front of us. We lost count of the number of longhorns, and we caught sight of a few dozen bison. Some grazed right along the road. Wanting to get in one more hike, we chose the Narrows Trail, 1.6 miles round trip, and hoped the deep ravine would block the wind. The trailhead isn't clearly marked. It begins just behind Boulder Cabin. Rock hopping is required to cross the creek midway down. Except for a couple of rock climbers in the distance, we were alone on the trail, which rises quickly above West Cache Creek. The views from the top, looking back down the valley, are stunning. After spending a year worrying about the safety of my children, I was a bit unnerved at first when they started exploring unstable rocks on their own, but they had a blast, bouldering, as they called it. They both said it was their favorite part of the weekend. Before leaving for home, we drove up Mount Scott. Hikers and bikers can start ascending at sunrise, but on weekends it's closed to cars until noon. Although there are several pull-offs on the drive up, we didn't stop until we reached the top with its 360-degree view. From there, you can see the entire refuge and look down over the town of Medicine Park. On our drive to the refuge the day before, Madeline had asked, "What's the best thing about Oklahoma?" I had to be careful with my answer because my wife was born and raised in Oklahoma, and much of her family still lives there. I joked that being close to Texas was the state's best asset. At least, I tried to my best to make it sound like a joke. My daughter persisted. No, what do people in Oklahoma love about Oklahoma? I settled on the Sooners, having casinos in nearly every city, and Lake Texoma, where we spend many weekends as a family. But on the way home, I began to think the Wichita Mountains might just be the best thing about Texas's neighbor to the north. Another little sidebar here. For a nostalgia trip, you can get your kicks on Route 66, because Oklahoma offers more miles of driving on its classic highway than any other state. A bonus tip, the verdant eastern stretch cuts through Tulsa, where a short, let's call it mandatory detour, brings you to Kane's Ballroom, known as the home of Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. The Mother Road, covering about 2,400 miles from Chicago to Santa Monica, was decommissioned as a federal highway in the 80s, but the quest for adventure and prosperity it represented still pulls in nostalgia seekers and those inspired by the Route 66 canon, which includes the Grapes of Wrath, On the Road, and National Lampoon's Vacation. Don't have time for an epic journey? Even a short section of 66 offers enough retro diners, quirky museums, kitschy landmarks, and faded glory for you to document on Instagram. And that was put together by Gene Shidness. And next we're going to turn to our other neighbor to the east. It's Louisiana, crawfish and wonder in Cajun country. Swampland adventures make the RV life worth it. This is by Amanda Iyer Ward. And we start with the little sidebar pit stop. New Orleans chef Nina Compton of Compère Lapin of the Warehouse District stands out in this restaurant capital. Her Caribbean roots and French culinary training meet her love of Italian cuisine in dishes such as curried goat with sweet potato gnocchi and cashews. And the article. In my 48 years, I've experienced a few crystalline moments when I've tricked time, evaded the rules of physics, and been hit by a wave of wonder. The first time was atop the Acropolis in Athens. I no longer heard the sprawl of moped traffic or worried about which gyro place to hit for lunch. Instead, the present day disappeared. It was awesome in both the filled with awe sense and the Jeff Spicoli surfer accented sense. I've chased that feeling ever since, discovering it in flashes during a quiet moment on the Nile with monkeys in Costa Rica, on a pontoon boat in the middle of Lake Buchanan, in the shade of Santa Elena Canyon in Big Bend National Park. In such instance, it is as if I'm connected to something larger and am at one with those who've come before me, as if I've been given a secret portal to beauty, to a place that is tender and precious. It's not easy to find those moments. They come or they do not, no matter how much you plan. But in the midst of a rough and scary year, I was overjoyed to find myself in the middle of the Atchafalaya River Basin and gazing at two ospreys circling a bald cypress. I found escape and awe in a Louisiana swamp. My husband, three children, and I like to think of ourselves as an adventurous family. In the first days of the pandemic, we dreamed of places from which we could work remotely if we could just magically transport ourselves. Hawaii? Manhattan? Paris? A year later, the thrill of working from home is gone, and we just want reliable electricity and broadband for all our Zoom classes and meetings. The thought of strapping on an N95 mask and boarding a flight seems less exciting than exhausting. Still, we've missed restaurants, concerts, and meeting new and old friends. So when we cooked up the idea of a COVID-19 safe vacation to nearby Louisiana, driving an RV to minimize contact with the outside world, I savored the zing of a new escapade. Besides, they call the Atchafalaya National Heritage Area America's foreign country. A little break here real quick while we're on the same page. I'm going to read this other sidebar. This one is entitled Book a Room for a Little Bit of Luxury. Where one of three new or renovated hotels in New Orleans, because do you need a reason to go to New Orleans? Anyway, the Chloe, what could be more New Orleans than staying in the new 19th century mansion on St. Charles Avenue with the streetcar passing by. The intimate Chloe, which opened in October, has 14 rooms, each with different features that may be a surprise or two. A trick bookcase, a wardrobe that also serves as the entrance to a private bath, as well as a restaurant and poolside patio and bar. Each room comes with a record player. Guests can borrow from the hotel's vinyl collection, curated by Peaches Records. Rates start at $350 a night. Columns, just three blocks down St. Charles from the Chloe. Columns recently underwent a renovation to restore some somewhat modernized the famous hotel, which, like the Chloe, was originally a 19th century mansion designed by New Orleans architect Thomas Sully. Known for its cocktail-perfect ports, the 20-room Columns reopened in October after being purchased by hotelier Jason Seidman in 2019. Its highly regarded restaurant and bar is now led by Michael Stoltzfus, the chef and owner of Coquette. Rates also start at $350 a night. And lastly, Hotel St. Vincent. Texas hotelier Liz Lambert, known for Austin's Hotel San Jose and Marfa's El Cosmico, and Austin restaurateur Larry McGuire, who did Perla's and Elizabeth Street Cafe, are the team, via the newly formed Lambert-McGuire design, behind one of the city's most anticipated new lodgings. Slated to open in late spring, the Hotel St. Vincent on Magazine Street in the Lower Garden District will feature 75 rooms, a guests-only lounge, and an Italian restaurant, San Lorenzo. In its past lives, a historic property has been an orphanage and a guest house. Rates start at $289 a night. And that was all put together by El Casimu Harris. We turn now back to our text. And so, along with our miniature schnauzer, we embarked on a project as ambitious as any of our friends' impromptu house renovations, homemade breads, or puppy adoptions. We rented an enormous RV. We had never driven one before, using an online service akin to Airbnb for RVs, and headed to Cajun country. While my husband, Tip, downloaded Swamp Pump and New Orleans Funk playlists, I booked tours and peered at maps. We had lived in New Orleans before we had children, but we were looking forward to getting to know a different part of Louisiana, the area around the Atchafalaya Basin, just 2.5 hours east of Beaumont. My 9-year-old daughter, Nora, a vegetarian who knows more about flora and fauna than any of us, packed sparkling outfits for swamp excursions. We would need to avoid Cajun dance parties, festival crowds, and eating in cozy seafood restaurants, but we were drawn to stories of the largest river swamp in the United States, of twisting bayous, alligators, and hundreds of species of birds, a natural world that was still safe. Unfortunately, our RV arrived with problems. Before I was aware of them, I oohed and aahed as a thoughtful technician walked me through the exterior and interior of our behemoth on wheels. In retrospect, I should have asked for a manual, a toolkit, the tech's phone number, or even better, a hotel suite. I thought it'd be easy to rent and enjoy a 29-foot-long 2019 Coachman Freelander. I was wrong. The kids could not have been more thrilled to explore the space, a master bedroom with a cozy king-size bed but no sheets, a teeny-weeny bathroom, lacking the special RV toilet paper I had ordered, a sweet kitchen with a fridge and freezer that didn't seem to work, a table that converted into one bed, a couch that converted into another, and a crow's nest space over the driver's seat that my 13-year-old Harrison immediately claimed as his Fortnite gaming space. "There are hangers," cried Nora, checking out the closet and many drawers, which would slam open and shut as we barreled along Interstate 10. "Wow," said my 17-year-old Ash, who decided in the end to stay at his best friend's house instead of missing school. And thank goodness for that, because while the posting claimed our coachman slept 8, I realized right away that 4 and a schnauzer was going to be a stretch. "What, is someone supposed to sleep in the shower that doesn't work?" said Nora 3 days later. Around midnight, a piercing beep began emanating from the RV, which was parked in front of our house. We tried to reach the rental service and the RV's owner while running to the Valero to get batteries for the fire detectors and wondering if we should cancel our trip. Finally, a text from the RV's owner explained that the problem was likely a low generator battery. Running the motor stopped the sound. As I lay awake in my house, bags packed with coffee, dog food, rain jackets, chocolate, books to read, a PS4 gaming system, and Nora's 2 dozen colors of nail polish, I began to wonder whether, despite our shoestring travels all over the world, a luxury RV vacation to a neighboring state might prove too much for us. The next morning, a little sleep-deprived, we decided to go for it. As we lurched out of town, I asked Tip excitedly, "How does it feel?" Gripping the steering wheel, he said, "Like a wonky bus." When a car cut in front of us, Tip hit the brakes and both kids and their Zoom school computers flew forward, crashing to the ground. The dog whined in terror. We were on our way! We arrived in Beaumont in time for ice cream desserts at La Real Michoacana before heading to our first RV park, Hidden Lake. We attempted to connect the RV to power and water, but quickly realized that we did not know how. Undeterred, we set out our new camp chairs under oak and yupon trees, opened cold drinks, and enjoyed a quiet night, a yellow moon, and the sweet sound of killdeers. I could hear more birdsong and trucks on the highway, a symphony of almost to Louisiana. The mysterious beeping started again as we crossed the state line and headed toward the small city of Brobridge, 8 miles east of Lafayette. Settled by Acadians around 1771, the crawfish capital of the world every May hosts the Crawfish Festival, at which you can enter a crawfish eating contest. The record is 55 3/4 pounds in 45 minutes, or simply watch the parade and listen to Zydeco and Cajun bands. By the time we reached town, we had found some sort of alarm in a drawer of the RV and switched out the battery. Feeling triumphant, we wandered the historic streets of Brobridge, stopping at Tanta Marie for a takeout order of hot beignets and beignets stuffed with spicy boudin. While there, I paged through a book of historic pictures. In my favorite photo, the smile on the face of 1974's Brobridge Crawfish Queen is bright. The velvet cape arranged in front of her features a glittering sequin crawfish. We also stopped by Poche's Market, Restaurant, and Smokehouse. A friend had begged us to bring her back some pork tasso, one boudin link, two packages of crawfish tails frozen in their fat. We made sure to order the same, plus a crawfish stuffed chicken and some pralines for the road. I also grabbed a red beaded necklace with a plastic crawfish pendant at the visitor center and impulsively pre-ordered a king cake at the Cajun Market Donut Company. In my defense, I did not order one made out of boudin, and I could have. Although it was getting colder, we had an appointment with Champagne's Cajun Swamp Tour to see some of the birds and wildlife at Lake Martin, part of the Nature Conservancy's Cypress Island Preserve, about 9,500 acres of swampland and bottomland. At home, we looked through our set of Sibley backyard birding flashcards in anticipation. We hoped to see alligators, of course, but also egrets, ibis, maybe even a great blue heron. I entered the Champagne's Cajun office and a woman cried, "Baby, you must be Amanda." It made my day. We hopped on a boat with a guide, and before we got far, saw three baby alligators sunning themselves. We all wore masks, but even with half of Nora's face covered, I could see her bright blue eyes wide with excitement. We entered the spooky, otherworldly swamp made up of bald cypress and tupelo trees. "You can catch a catfish over 50 pounds right here," noted our guide, Jimmy Blanchard. "Ooh, hey," he said, "look, nutria." We rushed to the side of the boat, eager to see the large, beaver-like swamp rodents. We watched as a mother nutria let her babies into the water, swimming away from us. One baby remained defiantly in the sun. "I like that one," said Nora. "She's not scared." Along our 60-minute tour, we saw so many winged creatures, black-bellied whistling ducks, cormorants, great blue herons, ospreys, ibis, that Tip noted he'd seen more birds than in his travels along the Amazon River. We paused to watch a couple of ospreys screeching above us, fighting over a fish. "Well, isn't that something?" said Blanchard. We were silent, reverent. I whispered, "Yes." We stayed that night at the Cajun Palms RV Resort, feasting on takeout pasta from the nearby restaurant Crawfish Town USA. After dinner and bread pudding with rum sauce, we finally figured out how to hook up the electricity and water. We enjoyed a night of movies and flushing the toilet. It was chilly and raining the next morning, and I was envious of the couple who drove by in a golf cart outfitted with its own custom rain jacket. We tried to crank up the heat, but all we could get was cold air. Indefatigable, Tip decided that we would drive along the Bayou Teche, 125-mile-long waterway, to where the land ends. The drive took us through Franklin and other small towns, and we spotted the old Spanish trail, which looked like a great spot for sunnier weather. For lunch, we stopped for red beans and rice at the coffee house in Jeanrette, where Harrison asked me to go inside and order more. "This is the healthiest lunch we've had in Cajun country," he said. Sheepishly, I pulled out the pralines, which melted on our tongues. Buttery, sugary pleasure. In New Iberia, we visited Jefferson Island and toured the glorious Rip Van Winkle Gardens in the rain, spotting a few blooming camellias and vowing to return to see the rosette spoonbills. A lovely cottage beckoned, and I must admit I almost booked a room and ran screaming from the RV, which was by now littered with dirty socks and takeout containers. That night, right about the time we discovered that water was leaking from somewhere, and the owners let us know they couldn't fix the heat remotely, Nora commented, "You know what? We're just not RV people." I had to agree. "How do you like the RV?" I asked Tip, just as the owners finally called us back, told us to unhook the water and stop showering and flushing. Tip, who is kind and diplomatic and 6'2", said, "This RV is not built for someone of my height." By the time of our reserved Atchafalaya experience tour, we were weary. Cold weather and an RV without heat or water had made us yearn to go home, but we decided to meet the father and son tour guides, both named Kim Voorhees, for a 4 to 5 hour private tour. Harrison said this sounded like a lot of time in a swamp. In the end, I could have spent 4 or 5 hours more. The Voorhees' olive green boat was welded by a friend to their exact specifications so they could move adroitly through the swamp. Tennis nets strung up along the sides helped protect against invasive jumping Asian carp, which both Kims insisted are scary as hell. They could leap high in the air and, without nets, right into your face. We glided deep into the swamp, seeing wood ducks, red-tailed hawks, and barn owls. Kim Jr. told us they're beginning to offer packages that combine their long-time birding tours with homemade meals. Take a little break here. Natural spot. Remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and the Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight and the Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and the Sound Broadcasting since 1967. Back to our text in Louisiana. Kim Voorhees Sr. interrupted his son with a high-pitched whistle. Surprised, we look around, and then we heard an answering call, an osprey high in a nest. Kim Sr. told us ospreys mate for life and showed us two pairs of juvenile ospreys. They've been listening to me since they were babies. I've been going out to that nest since they hatched out their eggs, and when they got on top of their nest, I pulled up and the babies would kind of dance and look at me, and the mama would sit there and dance. "You're really talking to the bird," said Harrison. Kim Sr. responded, shrugging. "After you do it 21 years, you can talk to anything out here." He steered the boat past a tree. They told us that seeing little blue herons meant that the migratory birds were coming back. We heard a black-bellied whistling duck, and Kim Sr. commented, "They sound like flying pigs, a little squeal to them." In a magical ancient cypress forest, we saw yellow and black-crowned night herons and a flock of ducks lifting into the air. "I've eaten everything that crawls, runs, and flies around here, but the tree duck is the best tasting," he said. Both fathers and sons' passions for their home was moving. They told us how in the fall the cypress glistened. Kim Jr. likes to take photographs in the thick morning fog. He posts them to his Facebook page. At the end of the tour, Kim Jr. gave us a stunning photograph from the cypress forest to remember the day. I was thankful for the picture, which I will hang in my office as a reminder of a shared moment so far from our ordinary days. On our last day of vacation, we climbed aboard a bright orange van to join the ebullient Marie Ducote-Como on her original Cajun taste tour, a three-hour journey with five stops at restaurants in the Lafayette area. We wore masks when we weren't sampling dishes and remained 6 feet from others on the tour. Ducote-Como, a proud Cajun, told us hilarious stories and insisted, "We're a melange around here, a mixture of cultures, not a melting pot, a gumbo." Speaking of which, we savored every bite of the chicken and sausage gumbo at Ton's Drive-In in Broussard. She also schooled us on the different ways to make boudin at Nunu's Fresh Market in Youngsville. Eventually, one is going to speak to you on a spiritual level. That's your boudin. We spent our last two nights at the Lafayette KOA in Scott. Among the campground's amenities were a sprawling pond with paddle boats, a mini golf course, an arcade, and two bathhouses for long hot showers. We made a fire in the fire pit and listened to Tip's playlist, humming along to Cajun Moon by J.J. Cale. In the morning, we would head back to Texas. I hoped I could hold on to the fragile peace I felt in the Atchafalaya Basin, watching birds circling their nest, Kim Sr. speaking to the osprey, and the osprey answering back. I'll spend a while trying to understand the lesson from this trip as I move forward in a perilous world. Maybe I need to learn from the Voorheeses to revere my home, to truly connect with beings around me and find joy and purpose in that communion. I think of my next-door neighbor who gave us a Christmas tree when my son was in the hospital and I didn't have time to buy one. I think of the screech owl that lives in the owl box my family made me for my birthday. I think of the flocks of American robins who had to fly all the way to Texas to find the ash juniper berries in bloom this year and who needed us to set out bowls of water for them when they finally arrived. On our last night on the road, I dreamed of an osprey opening its wings and soaring across the sky as clear and bright as my daughter's eyes. Amanda Iyer Ward is an Austin-based writer. Her most recent novel, The Jet Setters, on Ballantine Books, was published last year, and she's the author of this piece. And our next state on the tour of our neighbors, and last, is Colorado. Although it doesn't touch border with us, it's real close across Oklahoma and New Mexico. And this one opens with a pit stop. Don't miss the fry bread stuffed with Colorado bison at Tokabe, a fast casual American Indian restaurant in North Denver. Most of the ingredients are sourced from indigenous farmers. And we begin hiking the mountain trails less traveled. The hills are alive with socially distant adventures. It's by Pam LeBlanc, and it is indeed Colorado. As I emerge from an aspen-shaded stretch of the Cliff Creek Trail in Colorado's West Elk Mountains, I inhale big gulps of cool air and reveled in the muscle burn from miles of steep hiking. A 360-degree view opened around me, and except for my husband, Chris, I didn't see another soul on that July day in the middle of a pandemic year. I stopped, spun around a couple times, and pretended I was in the opening scene of The Sound of Music. Almost every summer, as Mother Nature fires up the annual blowtorch that turns Texas into a scorched expanse of burnt vegetation and wilted humans, I ditch my home state and head for the mountains of Colorado. Whether I'm gunning for vigorous exercise or just taking a break from screens and other people, outdoor adventures in this state give me the chance to focus on what brings me joy. The spicy smell of pine trees, awe-inducing geological formations, and the general grooviness of nature. Hiking in the Rocky Mountains always leaves me gobsmacked, but never so much as last summer when I traveled for the first time after months of isolating at home in Austin. Take that 11.4-mile Cliff Creek hike, for example. Those aspens I'd walked beneath weren't really thousands of separate trees. They were part of one of the largest aspen groves in North America, a single clonal colony that sends up shoots from the same root system. I just tiptoed across the fingertips of one of the world's largest living organisms, and the sheer audacity of that idea rattled around in my brain for days. The trail cuts through the remote West Elk Wilderness, 176,412 acres located within Gunnison National Forest in West Colorado, part of a network of pathways that branch off Kebler Pass, a 33-mile dirt road passable only in warm months that links Crested Butte to the east with Paonia to the west. Trails undulate up mountain flanks and curl around Coldwater Creeks. Chris and I slept in a rental from Native Camper Vans in Denver, which we parked for free on nearby public land. More than a third of the land in Colorado, roughly 24.1 million acres, is publicly owned, a sharp contrast to the 1.9% or 3.2 million acres of such land in Texas. Our week-long trip included other spots removed from the beaten path. We parked our van for a night between rows of apple trees at Big B's Fruit Company, an orchard and campground near Paonia. We also spent a day rafting the Arkansas River through Browns Canyon National Monument near Salida, and we explored the lightly visited north rim of the Black Canyon of the Gunnison, where you can look straight down into a nearly 2,200-foot deep gorge. But for me, hiking has always been the biggest lure to Colorado, a satisfying move at the pace of nature way to see up close the geology and plant life of a much cooler, in degrees that is, nearby state. Chris and I spent weeks backpacking the John Muir Trail in California and crisscrossing Montana's Glacier National Park on foot, but as with many other Texans, our go-to summer destination is Colorado. And while road trippers often head to popular spots such as Denver and the Garden of the Gods in Colorado Springs, I've always been drawn to farther-flung parts of the Centennial State, where, even before the pandemic, it was easy to have a socially distant vacation. A little natural spot to take a break here from the story. Get you our last sidebar. For a wellness break, soak in a hot pool at the Springs Resort and Spa in Pagosa Springs, Colorado, because this retreat features 24 terraced soaking pools fed by the world's deepest geothermal hot spring. Bonus tip, overnight guests can use the pool anytime they want, even at 3 a.m. Don't have a room? Day passes start at $39, or $45 on the weekends. Surrounded by the San Juan Mountains, in the southwest corner of Colorado, about an hour from Durango and 30 minutes from Chimney Rock National Monument, the Springs Resort and Spa offers a welcome respite on the banks of the San Juan River. Its mineral-rich soaking pools are fed by the 1,002-foot deep, at least, Mother Spring. Natural temperatures range from 80 to 114 degrees. One more attribute worth noting, the 79-room property, which includes a full-service spa, is owned by two Texans, Charles Letty of San Antonio and David Droney of New Braunfels. And that's put together by Kathy Blackwell. And now back to our text. One of my favorite destinations is the Colorado National Monument, a vast patch of high desert in the western part of the state just outside Grand Junction that ascends 2,000 feet from the Grand Valley of the Colorado River. The 31-square-mile park, which gets overlooked in all the buzz surrounding Rocky Mountain National Park, is to me a cross between the Grand Canyon and Utah's Arches National Park, with strange rock formations that look as if they were molded by a giant from one of those vintage Silly Sand kits. In the spring, you might see waterfalls spilling down rock faces that are typically bone dry. My last visit there coincided with driving rain and swirling fog, which foiled my plan to hike at least a few of the monument's 17 trails. But the soggy weather gave the place a mystical, almost eerie vibe, with red, yellow, and brown pillars of rock drifting in and out of view. In my van, I navigated 23 miles of juniper and pinyon-lined switchbacks, looking for bighorn sheep and bald eagles. A return trip to the monument is high on my post-pandemic travel list. I'll bring my mountain bike with me, a new 34-mile single-track bike trail called the Palisade Plunge, which drops 6,000 feet from the top of Grand Mesa to the fruit and wine mecca of Palisade on the valley floor, is scheduled to open later this year. I've already mapped out my itinerary. After I make it down the mountain, I'll stop by the tasting room at Peach Street Distillers for a celebratory shot of its small batch bourbon before collapsing in a bed at the Spoke and Vine, a motel built in 1955 that was refurbished a couple of years ago. Also near Grand Junction is the 36,000-acre Little Book Cliffs Wild Horse Range, its terrain looking for all the world like Big Bend. I once embarked on a hike there in search of the free-roaming wild mustangs that have inhabited the area for centuries. After following a trail up a ridgeline for an hour and stepping over an orchard's worth of horse apples, I finally saw four of the untamed beauties. Three females and a bossy stallion munched grass far below while I watched from a hill 200 yards away in awe. Yet another reward for exploring the state's more remote regions. Those who want more of a challenge and a literal change of scenery can hike from one mountain town to the next, as I did on a memorable trip to Crested Butte, which lies alongside the Maroon Bells pair of mountains in central Colorado. I stuffed a change of shoes and a nice dress into a day pack and drove to the West Maroon Trailhead, where Chris and I struck out on a glorious early September morning with a mission to hike 11 miles to the luxe resort town of Aspen. There we'll be checking into a hotel, grab a shower, and enjoy dinner and a night out before chugging back to Crested Butte the next day. Day one served up blue skies and t-shirt temperatures as we made the gradual climb past fields of purple and orange wildflowers to the 12,500-foot pass, where we paused to admire the foothills spilling out around us. From there, we descended 3,000 feet to Maroon Lake, where we caught a shuttle to Aspen. It's a challenging hike, but if you're relatively fit, you can make the trip in 6 hours, especially if you got grilled lamb or venison waiting for you at the upscale restaurant Bosque and a room at the posh Limelight Hotel. The return trip the next day reminded us of Mother Nature's dark sense of humor. We checked out the forecast and set out early, but a few hours in, a cold rain started. I yanked on a rain shell and gloves, but when the sleet hit, my skin dimpled like a plucked chicken. Then came the snow, big wet flakes that quickly turned the trail up and over the pass into a slip and slide. I've rarely been so cold, but we managed to thaw out a few hours later while sipping out chocolate in the lobby of the cozy Elk Mountain Lodge back in Crested Butte. It was a vivid reminder that it's possible to transition from summer to fall to winter in the span of 2 days in the Colorado mountains. And when it gets bitter cold, this Texas girl knows it's time to head home or go skiing. But that's another story. And the author of this, Pamela Blanc, is an Austin-based travel and adventure writer. We turn now to the states section. And first up, since we're already on a roll with travel, is Traveling Outdoors. It's an essay, though, by S. Kirk Walsh. It's entitled this month, Muses at the Zoo. The Asian elephants and their caretakers in Houston help a writer get to the heart of her novel. In the elephant barn at the Houston Zoo, a flock of swallows stitched the high rafters, while below, several more pecked at puddles of water between the feet of three pachyderms waiting for their morning feeding and bath. The muggy summer air was pungent with the smell of manure and wet hay. Along one wall sat plastic buckets filled with thick chunks of carrots and turnips. In this cavernous space, closed to the public, I focused on a young elephant called Tupelo, or Toop, to her handlers. With the help of two zookeepers, I was about to assist with her bath. Using a wooden brush, I carefully drew soapy circles against Tupelo's sturdy body. The stiff hairs that stippled the ridge of her back felt coarse under my fingertips. As she was hosed off, rivulets of foamy water traveled down the narrow valleys of her wrinkled gray skin. I'd never been this close to such a magnificent animal. I was mesmerized. Over the following years, I would often return to this day in August 2013. That short bath was our only shared experience, but I began to think of Tupelo, named, by the way, after Van Morrison's song, Tupelo Honey, as my elephant. I held her in my imagination as I worked on my debut novel inspired by the true story of Denise Weston Austin, a caretaker at the Belfast Zoo, who became known as the Elephant Angel after the German bombings of the Northern Ireland capital during World War II. Though I took some creative liberties with the book, much of the narrative follows what happened to Austin and Sheila, the elephant she protected. In my version, the young zookeeper is named Hetty, and her charge, Violet, is a 3-year-old Asian elephant, the same age and species as Tupelo. As I worked through many drafts of the novel, I recalled every detail of watching her, and it helped me write about Violet with clarity and precision. Like many fiction authors, when I started my project, I had no idea where the research and writing would take me. I first heard about Denise Austin and the Belfast Blitz on the radio in 2009, but didn't pursue it until a few years later. I was interested in exploring how I might be able to draw from my experiences of living in New York City during the attacks on the World Trade Center. As someone who is unable to have children, I also wanted to investigate the bond between a childless zookeeper and the animal in her care. In July 2013, my husband and I left our home in Austin to travel to Belfast, where I interviewed the survivors of the Blitz and interviewed and visited the zoo. There, a curator recounted the history of the attraction, which opened in 1934, and told us about the four nights of Luftwaffe bombings in the spring of 1941, with the one on the evening of Easter Tuesday being the most devastating. The Ministry of Public Security, concerned about the danger if the animals were to escape, ordered the euthanization of a number of zoo animals, including bears and wolves. Fearing for Sheila the elephant, Austin hid her in her home at night. During my 2-day visit, I observed the elephants from a distance, but that wasn't enough. When I returned to Texas, I researched elephant exhibits at U.S. zoos and was happy to discover that the Houston Zoo had a robust program to study and breed the animals. A month later, I visited for the first time, which is when I met Tupelo. Covering 55 acres in Herman Park, the Houston Zoo, which marks its centennial next year, is home to more than 6,000 animals from about 700 species. Before the pandemic, it drew more than 2.4 million guests a year, making it one of the most visited zoos in the country and a popular cultural attraction in Houston. During the pandemic, visitors are required to make reservations online and wear masks. 4 years ago, the zoo's McNair Asian Elephant Habitat doubled in size after a renovation that included the addition of a 7,000-square-foot barn for the bull elephants and an enlarged habitat with a 160,000-gallon pool. That expansion stands in contrast to many other zoos across the country where elephant exhibits are diminishing or disappearing. Since the early 90s, about 30 zoos, including those in Detroit and San Francisco, have shut down their elephant exhibits, in part because of the cost of keeping elephants healthy, more stringent regulations requiring that the large mammals be given increased space to roam, and pressure from animal activists. 12 Asian elephants now reside at the Houston Zoo, 5 more than at the time of my visit in 2013. In addition to Tupelo, I met the rest of the herd that morning, including her mom, Tess. Small petals of faded pink pigmentation decorated the length of Tess's wrinkled trunk, an indication of her age, 29 at the time. Asian elephants have smaller bodies and ears than their African counterparts, and they tend to have more hair. According to National Geographic, the population of Asian elephants has decreased by about 50% over the past 75 years. An estimated 20 to 40,000 live in the wild. I was also introduced to another 3-year-old, this one a male named Baylor, after the nearby Baylor College of Medicine, a longtime collaborator of the zoo. Tupelo was immediately charming. She gathered a bundle of hay in the curl of her trunk and tossed it upward. Much of the straw landed on her head, creating a self-made crown. As I quickly learned from the zookeepers, the trunk of an elephant is as agile as a hand. It can pick up something as small as a sunflower seed or a raisin, but it also has the suction power of a vacuum cleaner. On this morning, Daryl Hoffman, who carries the impressive title of Large Mammal Curator, produced a harmonica from its pants pocket and gave it to Tess. She easily handled the small instrument with her trunk and blew into it, high-pitched notes lifting into the musty air. I wasn't there just to observe the elephants. For my book, I needed to understand the role of their caretakers as well. Hoffman moved among the elephants like the veteran he is. When I returned to the Houston Zoo a few months later, I spent several more hours observing the care and training of the herd. This time, Tess was pregnant and was scheduled to undergo an ultrasound. It required a team of four zookeepers clad in plastic smocks and long plastic gloves to perform the challenging task of cleaning out her rectum before the exam and keeping her calm. When Tess was ready, the zoo's chief veterinarian, Dr. Joe Flanagan, maneuvered the imaging machine until a grainy picture appeared on the screen. "That's the baby elephant," he said, with a trace of joy in his voice. When Flanagan had completed the exam, Tess swiftly unfolded herself from the wet floor. As a reward, she got a large pumpkin, which she cracked open with one foot before collecting bits and pieces of the orange flesh with her trunk. After the morning feedings, the herd of elephants lumbered out into the exterior yard, giving visitors what they came to see. Along a bank of windows on the far side of the yard, school children pressed their faces against the glass in awe and delight, hands cupped around their eyes as they took in the majestic creatures. Recently, I talked again with Hoffman about his relationship with the elephants. I've worked with a lot of different species over my 30-ish years in the business, and there's no bond that even comes close to what you have working with elephants, he said. Hoffman also told me that Tess's pregnancy in 2013 had sadly ended in a miscarriage, but that she later gave birth to another calf, Tilly. Now she's not only pregnant with another due in April, but she just became a grandmother. On March 10th, Tupelo, who is now 10, gave birth to a 284-pound baby girl, Winnie, after a nearly two-year gestation period. Because Tupelo is related to all the male elephants at the zoo, she was impregnated via artificial insemination. The addition of Winnie makes the Houston Zoo one of the few in the country to host three generations of an elephant family. The fact that we have a multi-generational family group provides the elephant with so much diversity and enrichment, Hoffman explained during our recent Zoom interview. This breeding success allows zookeepers and veterinarians to work closely with the Baylor College of Medicine on research that can contribute to the welfare of Asian calves, both in captivity and in the wild. Spring is considered the season of birth and renewal, so I find it fitting that my novel, The Elephant of Belfast, was published in early April. After 4 years of research and writing, I'm excited to finally introduce readers to Hetty and Violet. And now that I'm newly vaccinated, I hope to return to Houston and congratulate Tupelo on her new baby. The author of this, S. Kirk Walsh, is an Austin-based writer, editor, and teacher. Her debut novel, The Elephant of Belfast, on Counterpoint Press, was released April 6th. Now, we're still in state. We turn out of style and design. This is made in Texas by Anna Mazurek. It's entitled this month, Carving a Niche. The maker is Philip Morley of Philip Morley Furniture, located in Wimberley, Texas. In a workshop next to his Wimberley home, Philip Morley creates custom wood pieces, such as record player consoles and the Morley Rocker, a sculptural chair he originally designed for his wife when she was pregnant with the first of their four children. The 38-year-old craftsman, who grew up in London, embraced woodworking during his troubled teen years after a judge sent him to trade school full-time. He moved to the U.S. in 2003, eventually becoming an apprentice to Austin furniture maker Michael Kolka. Morley, who branched out on his own in 2014, now has more than 146,000 followers on Instagram. "I am not a tech person," he says, "but it brought me great exposure." And another thing here we come to is still in state. We got Meanwhile in Texas, a collection of various news stories, headlines, things just put together by Sierra Juarez. Cleveland Browns quarterback Baker Mayfield said he spotted a UFO dropping straight out of the sky in Austin, his hometown. The Texas Department of Public Safety accidentally sent out an Amber Alert reporting that Glenn Ray and his father, Chucky, dolls from the Child's Play horror films, had been seen in Henderson. A man walked into a meeting at a Longview Children's Museum, pretended to be conducting a CIA investigation, and demanded attendees give him their cell phones before being recognized as the husband of an employee and reported to police. A 37-year-old Fannette woman who was adopted as a child took an ancestry DNA test to find one of her half-sisters from whom she was separated more than three decades earlier and ultimately reunited with her. Using some of the $134 million he amassed over six-plus years by allegedly billing insurers for fake prescriptions, a Houston pharmacy owner purchased a Ferrari, a Bentley, and a mansion. Sheriff's deputies rescued a caged tiger from a Bexar County property and transferred it to a sanctuary after a neighbor reported that the big cat was crying in the cold during the February freeze. An 8-year-old Primera boy who was slurring his words was taken to the hospital after his mother gave him a cookie that contained marijuana. 50 years after losing her engraved wedding ring in the Chicago snow, a woman in San Antonio received a Facebook message that a stranger had found it. And real quick, I'll let you know what's going on over here at Best of the Web. Meanwhile, over on TexasMonthly.com, Simone Biles on the outrageous vault she might try in Tokyo. Most decorated gymnast in U.S. history intends to retire from competition after the Olympic Games in late July. Devorah Myers speaks with Biles, who lives and trains in spring, about the postponed Olympics, the radical new skill the athlete's been working on, and learning to be vocal about one's political beliefs. They just moved into an Austin neighborhood. Now they want to end one of its traditions. Car clubs have gathered for decades at Fiesta Gardens, or Chicano Park, as locals call it, in the East Cesar Chavez neighborhood. But as Peter Holly reports, residents of a new luxury apartment building there are calling the police to stop them. Inside the red-hot rise of Chilito Candy, these sweets, also called dulces enchilados, have been making the mouths of Texans pucker for at least as long as we've been hitting piñatas. Today, Luis G. Rendon explains, young Latinos are setting the internet on fire with new interpretations of the classic Mexican treats. A new genre is here, the COVID-19 movie. First of these films, a handful of which premiered at this year's virtual South by Southwest, are poised to address a pandemic that isn't through with us yet. Dan Solomon argues that these early, imperfect takes on the past year are still worth watching. Meet the Jersey guy who wants to be a Texas cowboy and congressman. Dan Big Dan Rodemer, a former professional wrestler from Denville, New Jersey, is running as a Republican for a seat in Texas's 6th Congressional District. Rodemer achieved internet infamy after he released a corny campaign ad in which he speaks in a fake Texas accent and appears to get bucked off a bull named Nancy Pelosi. Commentators call Rodemer a phony, but as Christopher Hooks points out, many political ads are kind of fantasy. And lastly, how to spend a Texas weekend in Roscoe and Sweetwater. These small, far-flung towns don't beckon tourists the way the mountains of Big Bend or the spring-fed rivers of Central Texas do. But Pam LeBlanc makes a convincing case that Roscoe and Sweetwater are worth a stop for live music, a fascinating museum, and some dang good home cooking. And that brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2, on Sight Into Sound Broadcasting, your print.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center's Psychiatry Department will host free virtual monthly webinars covering multiple mental and behavioral health concerns. Each month, the public can join in through Zoom and listen to TTUHSC physicians and residents speak on topics ranging from depression, autism in children, PTSD, eating disorders, and much more. The public can find more information on TTUHSC Permian Basin's Facebook page or by emailing pb-psychadmin@ttuhsc.edu.
For a fun break from the heavy news of the day, we'd like to invite you to join us for the Lifestyle Show. This program is made up of fun features from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American.
Simple composting for simple gardeners.
Bon appetit. Chef struck by Eoff's dream for downtown Odessa.
Consider music to help foster plant growth.
West Texas artist creates frying pan fire for ENAM.
Owners of Miss Casey's honored by BPW.
Music minister seeks to unify people.
Museum of the Big Bend completes video touchscreen upgrades.
Walk on the wild side. First grade teacher loves the wildlife.
USS Texas Battleship soon will have a new home by Tumbleweed Smith.
Hints from Heloise. Don't store apples, carrot in same crisper drawer.
Master Gardeners tips for succulent care.
The Lifestyle Show. Friday mornings at 6 and repeated Sunday nights at 7:30 and Thursdays at 4:30 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 82 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-60s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the May issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the article Quintessentially Texan. A longtime Texan searches for the soul of the state in its most legendary landmarks, by Roberto Jose Andrade Franco. Growing up along the El Paso Juarez border, I was a long drive from where much of the prevailing stories of Texas history took place. El Pasoans, revolutionary heroes, came from Mexico. Our cowboys were vaqueros, and our missions mainly told the history of Native Americans. Even if some of our schools were named after people who fought for Texas's independence, those names hardly meant anything to me since I didn't grow up hearing their well-known stories, real or mythic. Of course, even in the westernmost corner of the state, it was almost impossible to live unaware of the Texas ideology. I knew the Alamo existed, but it was so distant from my world, it might as well have been in New York. It wasn't until I moved to Dallas in 2014 that I noticed just how much its story is ingrained in the identity of the state. I've read more about Texas this year than ever before. Thick tomes like Stephen Harrigan's Big Wonderful Thing, and smaller books like Richard R. Flores's Remembering the Alamo. Both ask weighty questions about what a place like the Alamo means. The short answer, it depends on how our present circumstances influence our view of the past. I read books written by Texas writers and by outsiders obsessed with the state's legends. I read about things I had just absorbed from living here. Not even 2 months into 2021, I had read 11 Texas-related books. My reading inspired me to finally set out to see these foundational places with my own eyes. First up was the Alamo, where I placed my palm on the cool stone walls that had been there since there was a Texas, before there was even a United States. Next, I visited the Fort Worth stockyards and walked the same brick-paved roads where countless longhorns and cowboys once strode. In El Paso, I had lived most of my life between two places, and neither one of them made me think I was Texan. I wanted to find out if traveling to these touchstones could change that. A common misconception from visitors is the size of the Alamo, said Michael Marino, a supervisor at the Historic Mission. During his tours, he often points to a map he carries while walking the sidewalks between the Alamo's structures, statues, and trees with thick winding limbs. Marino has worked at the Alamo for 5 years, his love of history nourished from his childhood in Brownsville, where he grew up, hearing stories of folklore, local leyendas, legends, and history. Like most first-time visitors, I also imagined the Alamo would be bigger. I'd read so much about how it casts the longest of shadows over Texas and the world's view of Texas. It's a top historical tourist destination. English musician Phil Collins owns the biggest collection of Alamo artifacts, 400 of which will be on permanent display at the Alamo starting spring 2022.
I expected the Alamo to be the size of a football stadium, the type of building seen from miles away, swallowing everything surrounding it with its presence. But the Alamo, or what remains of it, is easy to miss in part because it's nestled between towering buildings. Visitors are always genuinely surprised that the Alamo is at the heart of the city, Marino continued. They usually assume it's outside of the city limits in the open land. I first glimpsed it the previous evening. Since I had read Lawrence Wright's God Save Texas, where he describes the Alamo as, quote, yellowed by the patina of age, like old teeth, I almost expected the area to smell funny. It didn't. The Alamo looked even smaller at night, when only its facade was illuminated by floor lights. It also looked more peaceful. Except for the stray tourist, there was hardly anyone around. With most of the downtown traffic gone, the Alamo looked especially removed from the 13-day siege that destroyed 80% of the structure. Gone are the four walls and gate that helped guard the four-acre fort in its days as a mission on the Texas frontier. Gone are the headquarters from where William Barrett Travis wrote his letter to the public saying the Alamo was under attack, asking for help, but also vowing to never surrender or retreat. That's the same letter Governor George W. Bush read aloud to inspire the 1999 U.S. golf team when it was losing to Europe in the Ryder Cup. Perhaps it was just a coincidence, but the U.S. team won. When I visited it again the next morning, this time venturing inside, somberness replaced the previous day's tranquil feeling. The building most associated with the Alamo is a church, which made me feel as if I had to whisper. And the Alamo is still the site where 185 years ago, 189 people died fighting for Texas independence. No prisoners taken, all bodies burned. The Alamo is a site of reverence, Marino said. It's a symbol of the Texas spirit. Foreign visitors have told him about their country's last stand battles, which, like the Alamo, have become mythologized in forming part of their national identity. These stories are easy to inherit, difficult to untangle. In Texas, they've become part of the landscape. A short walk from the Alamo's long barrack, the Alamo Cenotaph stands 50 feet high and is made of pink Texas granite and gray Georgia marble. Travis, James Bowie, Davy Crockett, and James Bonham, those figures whom I'd always heard of but until recently didn't fully appreciate, stand out from the rest. While the monument includes other figures, these four are larger and their names are listed above each of their heads, unlike the rest that are etched around the base. In recent years, the monument became a point of contention. As part of the Alamo Plaza's makeover, a proposal to move the monument a few hundred feet south aroused anger from some history buffs. The various reasons included believing the cenotaph is located where the Texas Revolutionaries are buried, which Marino called a long-standing myth. People gathered to protest the proposal. One woman arrived on horseback. A few people spoke with their voices full of emotion, and some, because the chapel and barracks that were once Spanish, then Mexican, are today as Texan as cowboys and longhorns, equated their fight with the original defenders of the Alamo. The protest worked, and the monument stayed put. My family moved away from Texas in the mid-1980s, when it became clear that my father's job as a mechanic wouldn't provide enough to sustain our family. My father joined the U.S. United States Army, and after that we were always on the move until we returned to El Paso in time for me to attend high school. We lived in places like Colorado and Chicago, and even farther away from Texas, in Germany. One academic year, I attended four different schools on military bases. On my first day of school in the middle of the semester, teachers told me to introduce myself to the class. I said something like, "My name is Roberto and I'm from El Paso, Texas." As soon as I said Texas, I knew what was coming next.
Questions from classmates, sometimes even the teacher, asking if I rode horses, owned cows, or dressed like a cowboy. More than once, someone shouted the slogan of the state's anti-littering campaign, "Don't mess with Texas." I grew tired of telling my classmates